Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
A year-old accusation throws an unpleasant national media spotlight on a Florida collegiate athletic superstar.
To adjudicate this in the court of public opinion, whether that's an explicit attempt by the lawyers or not, surely that's the way it's playing out.
Also this week, a professional soccer team will call Orlando home, much to the delight of young fans like this one.
Because more people are becoming interested, they decide to play soccer probably, and they get better and better. They might grow up, and it might keep going and going.
We'll also have the latest jobs numbers, get ready for college and career, hear what Floridians are saying about the Common Core curriculum, and learn about a type of copying machine that can make handguns. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Here's yet another sign that the Great Recession has finally receded into history. The Florida Department of Economic Opportunity announced today that the state has reached its lowest unemployment rate since August of 2008. The new seasonally adjusted mark of 6.7% represents an estimated 625,000 people out of work. The department estimates there were 18,000 fewer jobless people in October than in September, when Florida's unemployment mark stood at 6.8%. The October number also represents 31,000 fewer people being out of work than back in August. That was the last monthly jobless figures available before today's release. The September numbers were delayed, as you recall, because the U.S. Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics suspended all data collection during the federal government shutdown. The drop in the overall number of unemployed outpaced the number of people who simply left Florida's workforce between September and October. That number was estimated at around 9,000. Governor Rick Scott, who's expected to use the reduction in the unemployment rate as a key to his reelection effort next year, continued to credit his tax and regulation reduction policies for the latest job gains. Regular listeners to Capitol Report know that we don't do many sports stories in the program, but you don't have to be a sports fan to know what the biggest sports story has been in Florida recently. As Stan Jastrzebski reports, coverage of sexual assault allegations against Florida State University quarterback Jameis Winston has dominated news cycles recently, and that notoriety may help decide how the case is adjudicated.
It's been hard to turn on almost any media outlet available in Florida lately without hearing about the Florida State University football team. And the stories aren't about the team's remaining schedule.
Poised to play in and possibly win the national championship, a frontrunner for the Heisman Trophy Award, Florida State quarterback Jameis Winston now possibly finds himself in some hot water.
Florida State quarterback Jameis Winston is being investigated for a sexual assault complaint filed in 2012.
City of Tallahassee commissioners were alerted about Jameis Winston's allegations of sexual battery the day before the story broke.
Jameis Winston's DNA.
We're talking about Jameis Winston.
Nobody has talked to Jameis Winston.
Experts say that media coverage of the allegations against Jameis Winston may be influencing the story, not just chronicling it.
You would like to think that the media would treat a star quarterback the same way it would treat anybody else who falls into an investigation like this. That would be the ideal situation. Unfortunately, that's not always the case.
Lester Munson is now a legal analyst for ESPN. He's also a lawyer and teaches classes at Northwestern University on the intersection of sports, the law, and journalism. He's been called upon regularly in recent days to interpret the case on ESPN's programming. He says he does not fault the media for using public records requests to bring to light a nearly year-old case.
There must be media scrutiny of any investigation, any prosecution. We do not need to have police and prosecutors working without the public spotlight on them, especially in a case of this level of notoriety.
But FSU communications professor Arthur Rainey says it's also important to note what outlet is disseminating the information, because that may set a tone for how the rest of the story unfolds.
When TMZ
the gossip related website and outlet is the one breaking this story, right, it does call into question the credibility immediately in some people's eyes. Absolutely, then, the way that the story gets initially framed by the outlet who breaks it has an impact on the way then people perceive it.
The tone of the Winston story has exhibited notes of the tabloid style TMZ is known for. Information has broken by way of leaks from law enforcement officials to ESPN, and the 24-hour news cycle has been consumed with the he said, she said that's ensued between the lawyers on both sides of the case, both of whom insist they originally wanted to keep the investigation out of the public eye. Rainey says that tone has since pervaded the news space, and sometimes to journalism's detriment.
I saw a poll the other day on a media's website that was basically, is Jameis Winston guilty? Is he innocent? Well, it really doesn't matter what you and I think, right? There's a legal process here, and the fact that people's opinions at this point become the story itself, I think, can be quite problematic.
But Munson says the media's tone might actually make the investigation move more quickly. Tallahassee State Attorney Willie Meggs has said he'll rule soon on whether to file charges against Winston, but what soon means is anyone's guess. No matter when it happens, Munson says the process often seems to move more quickly in Florida because of the state's sunshine laws allowing journalists easier access to public records.
They know that they can keep no secrets, and therefore they work at a higher level than you see when you look at prosecutors in other states.
But Munson says if Meggs delays too long, the media could begin to focus more on him and not on the Heisman Trophy contending quarterback whose fate hangs in the balance.
If he postpones his decision and allows Winston to play out the season and even a bowl game, then he's going to get the kind of criticism that he, to me at least, so far is trying to avoid.
FSU Athletics Media Relations Director Rob Wilson declined to comment on the media coverage of his school's starting QB, but did say his department is not keeping Winston under wraps, even though the redshirt freshman's lawyers have all but issued a gag order on any question concerning the case against him. And that's a subject the media is much more interested in right now than anything Winston could do on the football field. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Stan Jastrzebski.
As long as we're talking about football, there's a different kind of football that's kicking things up a notch in Central Florida. The Orlando City Soccer Club is becoming a professional franchise. Fans celebrated the announcement on Church Street in downtown Orlando Tuesday night. Amy Kiley reports.
I know you did. Purple-clad soccer fans sporting glow necklaces and Mardi Gras beads filled Orlando's Cheyenne Saloon, the street in front, and neighboring restaurants. They came to hear one thing.
It's my pleasure to welcome Orlando City SC as Major League Soccer's 21st expansion team.
That's MLS Commissioner Don Garber declaring the Orlando City Lions will go pro in 2015. Coach Adrian Heath added to the announcement with a promise.
We're going to be there to be the best team as possible.
That Orlando would be awarded an MLS team was no surprise following approval of an $84 million stadium. That required funding and political support all the way up to Governor Rick Scott. But when Scott stepped on stage Tuesday, Orlando soccer fans seemed unappreciative. Scott never did finish his speech, but eventually team co-owner Flavio Augusto da Silva provided the thanks the crowd had withheld. At least he tried.
The governor, Rick Scott, help us. Okay. Just a moment. I understand your politics, but a special thank I would like to have to the governor here, Rick Scott.
Support from politicians aside, what the team needs now is backing from fans. Professional clubs in Miami and Tampa folded from lack of it. Success depends on people like 9-year-old Natalie Reynolds.
Because more people are becoming interested, they decide to play soccer properly, and they get better and better. They might grow up, and it might keep going and going. Because I know someday that I could become one of them, and it just gets me excited.
When it comes to excitement, Orlando soccer fans know the feeling. I'm Amy Kiley in Orlando.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida school superintendents want to put changes to the state's public education system on hold for 3 years, but others say that's a non-starter.
But it sounds like those are adults that we're trying to take care of in the system.
Some experts say putting boys and girls in separate classrooms gets gender roles out of the way so students can learn better.
Boys love the pet bunnies. Girls love the pet bunnies. I don't believe there's any sex difference in how much kids like the pet bunnies.
You might think defining the term college and career ready might be a simple thing. You'd be thinking wrong.
The teacher's saying that I have to stick to a curriculum that was given to me by the state, and I really don't have time to teach a kid about life.
And federal officials are worried about a technological craze of 3D printing, particularly because creating usable guns made entirely out of plastic is not a thing of fiction anymore.
You can get started for only a couple $100, you know, $300. You can get a kit, you put it together, and then you buy your filament, download the control software, and then you can either go to a website, download models already made, or you can make your own.
We have a few education-related stories out of the Capitol this week. The first brings us up to date on the continuing dispute over whether or not Florida should adopt new learning standards in its public schools. This week, public school superintendents joined the chorus of those calling for a timeout on any changes to the existing standards. Lynn Hatter reports on the latest opposition to the Common Core curriculum.
All of the questions swirling around Florida's public education system have local school superintendents crying foul. In addition to the uncertainty facing teachers about what they'll be teaching, the superintendents say there are other issues that remain unresolved, like what to do about the state's sketchy school grading formula, how teacher evaluations will be conducted, and whether all public schools have the technology in place to meet all of the new demands.
Superintendents know that we cannot meet the demands of the accountability timeline.
Volusia County School Superintendent Margaret Smith voiced the opinion of the Florida Association of District School Superintendents when she suggested a 3-year pause on any changes.
We are respectfully requesting the State Board to pause with the implementation timeline and allow for a transitional period of 3 years.
That recommendation did not go over well with State Board of Education members like Kathleen Shanahan, who didn't mince her words.
The kids are performing. So you guys are asking for a 3-year status quo?
No, it's not really a status quo.
Shanahan likens the rollout to the state's new education standards to that of the federal government's health insurance exchanges.
The Obamacare rollout, I'm not going to say one word about the policy content. I'm just going to put a reminder out there that when you try to do stuff technically through government, you've got to be careful not to take on hubris that the private sector can do better.
Florida is at a crossroads when it comes to the future of public education. National education standards in English and math, called Common Core, have already been adopted. The standards were developed by states, but critics say there has been too much federal intervention. A review and recommendations for the standards could be done by the spring. Yet, as the Florida Department of Education begins to review the recommendations it's received, some State Board of Education members say some opinions should count more than others. Outgoing board member Shanahan has been a strong supporter of Common Core, and she says the comments should be screened.
There should be some way in the analysis that it's not, I don't want to say a random person, but a person that showed up to speak that doesn't have any classroom relevant experience, to have that be equally weighted with a teacher's experience in whatever the analysis that gets done, I would caution you to be careful about.
In addition to deciding Common Core's fate, the state is still grappling with what to do with new assessments that were supposed to be tied to the standards. Florida leaders initially joined a consortium of states using the so-called PARC exams. Now that, too, is in limbo as the state has opened competition up to other testing vendors. But PARC did get a bit of a boost at this week's state board meeting, with Education Commissioner Pam Stewart giving a brief synopsis of what states with better academic performance than Florida are using.
Massachusetts will choose PARC, and they have some assessments, some state-developed hybrid that is considered, and they may continue to use. Maryland has selected PARC, and New Hampshire will use, or at this time has selected, Smarter Balanced.
A decision on Florida's new assessments could also come by the spring. Superintendents say one option they don't like is Florida creating its own exams to replace the FCAT. Instead, they'd like to use tests that would allow the state's students to be compared with their peers across the nation. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
It wasn't too many generations ago that separate schools for boys and girls were fairly common in the world of America's private schools. Now, two Florida lawmakers want to test a theory that public school boys and girls might learn better if they're taught in separate classrooms. So they're filing a bill that would encourage schools to offer single-gender classrooms. But Regan McCarthy reports the proposal comes with quite a bit of controversy and confusion.
The Franklin County School District is one of the smallest and poorest in the state, with all of its kids eligible to get 3 free meals a day at school and just one campus to house all of its students from preschool through 12th grade.
Hey, are you behaving yourself? Yeah, you know who I'm talking to. Huh? You are? You got a good GPA coming on?
Nonetheless, taking a tour of the school with Superintendent Nina Marks can take some time.
Well, show me some of your skills. Show me what you can do.
The subject of the day is gender classes.
Okay.
So if I told you in elementary school that you were going to have all girls in a class or all boys in a class, would you want to try it?
If I was an elementary school PE coach or teacher?
Teacher. Classroom teacher.
At first, coach and high school athletics director Mike Sweat says he might prefer co-ed classes. But after thinking, he says separating kids by their gender could have some definite benefits.
In phys ed or even in the classroom, if I had a group of boys, I would probably teach different in there than I would have in co-ed or a group of girls. I'd probably teach different with the girls.
And that's one of the reasons Hialeah Republican Representative Manny Diaz says he wants to offer state money to schools that offer single-gender classes.
You know, there's a lot of research out there that it kind of indicates that boys and girls learn very differently. And there's social aspects within the classroom that can be intimidating to one or the others.
But Leonard Sachs, founder of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education, says it's not that boys and girls learn differently. Here's an example.
A sixth grade teacher brought in a rabbit, a bunny, for the students to see and to touch. And one of the girls said, "Oh, the bunny, it's so cute. Can I pet it? I want to pet it." And one of the boys said, "Oh, yeah, I want to blow its brains out with a bazooka." And from the moment the boy said that, none of the other boys wanted to pet the bunny because the gender lines had been drawn.
But bring that bunny into an all-boys classroom, Sack says, and you'll see a different outcome.
The teacher brought the bunny back to the all-boys classroom. And half the boys now wanted to pet the bunny.
So Sack says in separate gender classrooms, the goal isn't to help kids learn differently. It's more about asking them to do things they'll want to do. In Franklin County, Mark says that's something she could be interested in, though she says it would take a lot of studying and talking to parents first.
We would need a control group and, you know, you'd have to put a lot of things in place. And it takes time to try to figure that out in a staffing plan. And
given the size of Mark's school, working out the logistics could be hard. For example, there are so few kids attending second grade in the county, they've only got 2 second grade classes, meaning there couldn't be a boys' class, a girls' class, and a co-ed class. But Diaz says he wants the program to be flexible, so small schools have the option to implement it at any grade that's big enough, if not all at once. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida says his group is keeping an eye on the bill, which he says doesn't reflect the real world and could result in discrimination. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
After elementary, middle, and high school, of course, it's off to college for many and hopefully a career for all students. College and career readiness is a phrase educators throw around a lot. The definition of what readiness means depends on who you ask. Ryan Bank reports most experts agree that whatever college and career readiness means, too many Florida students aren't fitting the definition.
On average, around 160,000 high school seniors graduate in Florida every year. And more than 50% of the state's incoming college freshmen fail at least one section on the Sunshine State's college placement exam, forcing most students to spend their early college years catching up with remedial courses. That statistic has state business leaders like the Florida Chamber's Edie Owsley increasingly worried. She says Florida, the 4th most populous state in the country, has close to 60,000 science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM jobs, just waiting to be filled by qualified applicants.
Understanding that we believe in a talented workforce as being the key to our state's economy, we must prepare students for those future jobs and ensure, you know, that our students are moving in the right direction.
College placement tests aren't the only rubric for gauging college and career readiness. Before a student even enters an institution of higher learning, they have to take one of two standardized tests, the SAT or ACT. According to data released by the latter in August, only 19% of Florida students tested as college ready, which the testing administrator defines as how well a student will do in their first year of college. Although he acknowledges not every student is cut out for a four-year institution, ACT spokesman Ed Colby says his employer's college ready measure has broader implications.
What we have found is that the skills needed for workforce training programs that are required for lots of jobs that would pay a livable wage for a small family would require some of the comparable skills to first year college coursework in math and reading.
At Lively Technical Center's Automotive School in Tallahassee, students from diverse backgrounds and of varying ages are swapping out the components on a Chevy Silverado pickup truck so it can run on compressed natural gas. Instructor Kenny Adams is hoping the skills he's teaching will give his students an edge in the emerging natural gas industry.
This shop here is set up just for teaching compressed natural gas, which is becoming more and more available in the car line, and as it does, you know, we need techs that are trained to work on compressed natural gas vehicles.
Adam says he was surprised by the number of students who came into his class unprepared by their high schools. Many only arrived at the technical college after graduating high school and spending years with little career direction. One of those students is Patrick Anderson. He says after graduating high school, he joined the military, thinking it was his only option. After he finished his service, he felt ill-equipped for civilian work, a problem he traced back to his time in high school.
High school students, when they graduate today, they have more options available to them. I think when I graduated, which was several years back, we're talking almost 30 years, the opportunities wasn't as vast as it is now.
Florida students do have opportunities, but they're not always easy to find. That's why West Park Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones says he's filing a bill to mandate school districts offer a college and career readiness course to help guide students to careers they're really passionate about. Jones says because teachers are forced to spend most of their time teaching for standardized tests like the FCAT, students aren't learning the skills necessary to put them on track for a career that suits them.
The teacher's saying that I have to stick to a curriculum that was given to me by the state, and I really don't have time to teach a kid about life. Now, a good teacher knows how to maneuver their way and stick it in there to make sure that you take care of the holistic child. But then you have some teachers who really need that support.
Although he admits his bill wouldn't solve all of the state's career readiness woes, Jones does say creating separate classes where students can take job placement tests, learn to write resumes, and hone their career interests will mold more well-rounded students and put them in a better position to be successful post-high school. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. We wind up the week with a story that just a few years ago would have been considered science fiction. In less than 3 weeks, a long-standing ban on firearms that can't be seen by metal detectors may lapse. A Florida senator is trying to see that doesn't happen. But lawmakers aren't the only ones worried. As Sasha Cordner reports, artisans who use a new type of digital printer are worried what large-scale printing of firearms might mean for their craft.
Statistics on the actual use of illegal plastic guns are a bit spotty, but Chris Ammon with the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives says there is one number that troubles the agency.
A lot is unknown at this time, but it was estimated that the individual who printed and tested his model, his 3D printed firearm model called the Liberator, that his technical specs were downloaded by over 100,000 people. His name is Cody Wilson. As it stands now, it has to have metal in order to comply with the law. So it has to have that certain amount of metal to comply with the Undetectable Firearms Act. However, that law is up for expiration in December. So conceivably, you could manufacture these firearms without the metal. Therefore, you know, certain metal detectors, they would be undetectable. You could slip these into, you know, courthouses, airports, other places where, you know, large members of the public gather.
That's why several Democrats, including Florida Senator Bill Nelson, want to extend the longtime ban passed in the 1980s.
Obviously, weapons like this pose a very serious threat to our national security and to our personal safety. And we need to be doing everything we can to keep them off the streets.
Inside a Tallahassee shop called Making Awesome, there's a 3D printer at work making a gear, a common shape used to show off a 3D printer's skills. Making Awesome is a place where people can share and learn about different technology, including electronics, robotics, and 3D printing. Its top 3D printing expert is computer engineer Mark Trombley, who's showing off a number of different uses for 3D printing.
There'll be things about body parts, motorcycle parts, clothing. Here's a 3D printed human liver. Arms, or helping arms, supporting things to help kids that had problems with their muscles or bones. And these would strap onto them. And they were using them in developing countries because it's inexpensive. And use it for something positive.
Trombley, who built his own 3D printers from scratch, says the tech actually blossomed around the time the Undetectable Firearms Act was signed. Today, the technology is cheaper, with most printer kits costing between $300 and $3,000. And it's more accessible at home, which Trombley says is what might trouble law enforcement about plastic guns.
So you could go purchase a kit and purchase the materials and do it at your house. You don't have to send it out to somebody else. So when you have a company doing it, government or law enforcement can control, you know, they can say, okay, it's illegal to make this and you're going to have a problem doing this. Well, now you personally can do it. So now you're getting it to your level. And I think that's where the concern is right now, with people deciding to go around that process.
Florida Public Radio placed multiple calls to the National Rifle Association seeking comment, but got no answer on the organization's stance on plastic firearms. Still, even if someone owns the hardware to make a plastic gun, Trombley says they can't just print one. Each part must be manufactured individually.
I mean, there's assembly required. some assembly required. But yeah, these are the springs that would activate the firing pin. This would push against the firing, in this case, the nail, and then the bullet, little 22 bullet, sits inside this cartridge there.
So if we wanted to do that right now, we totally could.
Yeah, we could sit here and, I don't know if we could find if we could find a model, we could, right here, we could sit here and just start printing.
Trombley says he's never printed a gun and he doesn't want to start now, though it's not like he's never gotten any offers.
People throw it out as an anecdote from time to time. Oh, did you print a gun, or can you print me a gun? And I'm like, no, I don't print guns.
Meanwhile, the federal ban on undetectable firearms has been extended several times before, but it's unknown whether Congress will extend the ban again, set to expire December 9th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Bank, Sasha Kortner, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment, on the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.